Our next case this morning is John M. Floyd and Associates, Incorporated against Star Financial Bank. Mr. Fenton.
May it please the court. My name is Jim Fenton, and I'm here this morning representing the appellant. Good morning, Your Honors and counsel. Floyd, my client, brought this action for breach of contract against Star Financial Bank, and Floyd is appealing from a summary judgment that was entered in favor of the bank on the breach of contract claim. The essential facts are these. Floyd is a banking consultant. It analyzes bank operations and makes recommendations to improve the bottom line at banks. Floyd and the bank entered into a written consulting agreement under which Floyd was to be paid one-third contingent fee for its consulting services.
How large is the Floyd operation?
Your Honor, I would estimate that the company probably has somewhere around 50 employees.
It's based in where?
Based in Texas.
Texas.
Yes, sir. Texas Corporation, principal place of business in Texas. We contend that there's a material issue of fact in this case as to whether the bank approved and installed two of our recommendations, and that the district court accordingly erred in granting summary judgment to the bank. What I propose to do is tell you the three basic factual predicates upon which we believe we're entitled to a trial on that issue as to whether there was installation, and then I'll turn to the district court's legal analysis and discuss that. The first factual predicate that we believe is supported by the record is this, that the bank, after hearing our recommendation that they install what's called an overdraft program, an overdraft protection program, that the bank immediately thought highly of that recommendation, immediately approved of the recommendation in the sense of speaking favorably of it, and that the bank determined that it was going to install an overdraft program. In fact, our overdraft program we submit, but it was not going to pay us, it did not want to pay us the contingent fee. The bank immediately said, will you renegotiate? They said to us, we have already had a written agreement. Will you renegotiate with us and install your recommendation for a flat fee so we don't have to pay you one-third of the increased earnings? The bank immediately then thought to itself, well, we'll install it on our own. This is all in their own record, in their own minutes of their own executive committee. The bank immediately then thought, well, maybe we can install it on our own and not pay Floyd for its recommendation. And finally, almost immediately after our recommendation, they contact a company that installs very similar programs, a company who had visited them 8 months before and they had shown them the door. Suddenly they call that company back to their offices and they say, install an overdraft program.
What do you mean by install?
Install essentially, Your Honor, is creating the systems, the paperwork processing systems that will allow the bank to identify the customers who are eligible for a certain overdraft program, and then immediately either cover their overdrafts or not cover their overdrafts if they're not eligible.
Is this a software program or a paper program?
It can be done either way. In this particular case, as the court will note, the bank takes the position that it hired this other company because of the software. We take the position that that's a question of fact. The question is, did they hire the other company because it had some software available? Software we believe was not even necessary. Our programmer, our engagement manager, Mr. Rowe, testified that there was no necessity to buy additional software, that the bank's computer systems were such that we could have installed the program without the purchase of the additional software. But that's what we believe would have happened in this particular case. But we believe there's a question of fact as to whether the bank now says, well, and I'm sure opposing counsel is going to argue that we wanted to purchase that additional software. Our contention is that it's a question that may be a question of motivation, because if in fact they were trying to save over $400,000, rather than put in the software, that would be a jury question, and we believe that this evidence that I'm laying out would establish a jury question.
You know, counsel, before you get too much further down this path of factual disputes, none of them make any difference unless the district court misinterpreted the contract, and so I think you should probably start out with the interpretation of the contract rather than the factual disputes.
If
the district court got the contract interpretation issue right, then that's the end.
I would agree with you. If she interpreted the contract correctly, then that's correct. Our position, of course, is that if there was an installation of our recommendation, that entitles us to be paid. She took the position, the district court took the position, that we had to install in order to get compensated. We were deprived of the opportunity to install. And when I use install, I'm really using a shorthand because the bank installs. We simply assist in installation. That's what the contract, in fact, provides. But there is nothing in the contract that says, as a condition precedent, that we cannot recover unless we, in fact, install our recommendation.
Well, the contract's payment provisions do provide that the bank has the final decision as to which recommendations will be installed, and only, I'm quoting now from the contract, only approved and installed recommendations will be used to quantify earnings, and that is in large part what the district court focused on in determining that you weren't entitled to be compensated for recommendations that the bank didn't approve and you didn't install.
Well, that's where we think the district court erred, Your Honor, with all respect, because the contract does not say anywhere that Floyd must install in order to be compensated.
Well,
the contract says that the bank has the right to approve or disapprove recommendations, but our argument is that what that means is that the bank could either approve or disapprove a particular recommendation, and if it did not install a recommendation, obviously we're not entitled to any compensation. However, if they decide to install, and we believe the evidence is they decided to and did install our recommendation, or all essentially our recommendation, that we're entitled to compensation, that there is nothing in the contract that says that we're only entitled to compensation if we install. But I would add also, Your Honor, aside from the question of how to interpret the contract, as a matter of Indiana law and the law of just every other state, if a party such in the position of the bank takes the position that there's a breach of promise or a condition preceding which has not been satisfied, our installation, and we are ready, willing, and able to install, and they say, no, we're not going to let you install, we're going to have someone else install, that breach of condition or breach of promise cannot be relied upon as a defense to our breach of contract action. And so it's our position that even if you did read that language as creating a condition precedent, which apparently is what the district judge did, she overlooked the fact that when we were dealing with the bank, we were prepared at all times to perform that promise, to assist them in installing the program.
I don't know if the district court interpreted that payment language as a condition precedent. I understood the district court to have simply said that the bank would pay for only those recommendations that it approved and that were, in fact, installed when it came to actually quantifying the earnings that would form the basis of the contingency fee payment.
And as stated, Your Honor, we have no quarrel with that statement. We are not entitled to compensation for programs that are never installed by anyone. But if the bank installs one of our recommendations, or if a third party installs one of our recommendations, or if we install one of our recommendations, in any of those three cases, it's our position that we're entitled to be compensated under that contract. What the district court has done is in effect read that language as read that contract as creating a condition precedent to our right to recover. When in fact it's true, if the bank had said to us, "We want you to install," and we were unable to install or unwilling to install, and failed to install, we would be in breach of the agreement, and they would, that would have defeated our right to compensation. What happened here is the bank said, in fact, as you'll see in the record, the bank said, we approve of your program, we want to install it, we don't want to pay you the contingency fee, we want to pay you a flat rate. And then failing that, they said, we'll install it on our own. And failing that, they said, we'll hire someone else to install it. All of those facts, we believe, indicate that they approved of our recommendation, intended to install our recommendation, in fact did install our recommendation, and that that gives rise to our right to compensation.
Mr. Fenn, let me, just sort of a fundamental thing. You entered into a contract with the bank, and there was a set fee paid for the basic contract, right? And then there was these contingencies if, as you describe it, these were installed and so forth, and you'd be paid additional compensation.
Well, let me address that, Your Honor, because there's some confusion being created, I think, by the bank in that regard. We were paid a $110,000 fully refundable retainer, and then they did agree to pay expenses. We were paid a $110,000 fully refundable retainer. If we had not generated sufficient revenues, if we had not generated $330,000 worth of revenues, we would have had to pay all or part of that retainer back.
That specific amount, $330,000, was in the contract?
No, that specific amount is not in the contract, but
it's a percentage of...
Right. Given the one-third contingency fee, we would have had to generate at least $330,000. But if we had generated zero income for the bank, if all of our programs failed, or if they had rejected all of our programs, we would have had to give them back the $110,000. So for the bank to suggest that we are compensated somehow by the $110,000, I think is completely erroneous, because it is clear that it's a fully refundable retainer.
Now, the other question I had, is this an exclusive consulting contract, or do they have other consultants under similar circumstances?
Well, the agreement itself is not exclusive. Our position is that once they entered into a written agreement with us to consult about these specific matters, if we met the criteria for compensation under that agreement and were entitled to compensation, that they were restrained to some extent by the contract, because although they could, we do not claim that the contract prevents them from hiring someone else to install. Our position is that if they hire someone else to install, and they install our program, which is what we believe the facts indicate here, they have to compensate us as well. I mean, they could take the position, well, we don't care for your method of installation or something, but if they go that route, it's our position they have to pay us. Now, I mean, I make one further point on the district court's legal analysis. We think that the district court's legal analysis, with all respect, it runs afoul of this court's observation in the National Steel case, that when you have two fairly sophisticated parties, you ordinarily end up with a contract that's not, you know, absurdly one-sided. And if you do come up with an interpretation of a contract that is grossly one-sided, that should be an alarm bell. There should be the reasoning would appear to be suspect. Here you have a case in which, in effect, the bank takes the position that they were never really bound at all. They could always come, listen to our recommendations, install it, and not pay it, and we could walk away.
Differences between your program and the program that was installed.
Very few, Your Honor. We took the deposition of the vice president of the bank, who testified there were no major differences. The person who installed the program for the bank testified that the programs were similar. This is all in the record and all supports the denial of summary judgment. Our project manager said the programs were extremely similar. And
they either involve software.
Pardon?
It either involves software.
Both programs would have involved some kind of computerized system. They came along and decided to install a program in which there was a computer software that was being sold by this company. We have taken the position that they didn't need to purchase that software, that that software was irrelevant, that the program that we installed it would have used their existing software. They now say that that was enough of a difference to justify their going to this other installer. We say no, that was a trumped up difference. And if you read the deposition testimony of the vice president of the bank on this subject, I think you'll find that she essentially recanted her testimony that there was major differences between the two programs. We think it's a question of fact as to whether or not they installed our program or a substantially identical program, and that therefore we're entitled to a trial. We would ask the court to reverse the summary judgment. And I'll reserve my time.
Thank you, Mr. Fenton. You had used all of your time, I believe, but I will give you 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I will give Mr. Hiddle an extra 3 minutes now to...
Thank you very much. Even.
Your Honor, it's Max Hiddle for Star Financial Bank. With me on the brief is my colleague Greg Small, and also with us today is Mr. Dave Cornwell, Vice President and General Counsel of Star Financial Bank. Your Honors, as the Court has already portended by some of its questions, John Floyd wins this case only if this Court is willing to do two things. First, you would have to take your scissors and cut out of this engagement letter the language that says, quote, the bank will have the final decision as to the installation of recommendations, and only approved and installed recommendations will be used to quantify earnings. The second thing the court would have to do would be take a red pencil and add in a provision that does not presently exist in that engagement letter, and that would be an exclusivity provision. That would allow or require Star to use only Floyd exclusively for its consulting services for some undetermined amount of time.
Hiddle, maybe you could help me then with a problem I'm wrestling with. Sure. Even if I accept your view of that of the contractual provision, as I understand opposing counsel, he says, yes, but in this case, they took my program and installed it. In other words, that adds a different dimension to the problem, if that is true, does it not?
That would be a different dimension, Your Honor, but that's an end around. What they're trying to say is, at the end of the day, you need to look at the program that Star did, in fact, install. It walks like and talks like and looks like a Floyd duck, so therefore it must be a duck. That's not the analysis that has to come forth under Rule 56. Once we prove, either under the overdraft program or under the credit card portfolio, that either we did it ourselves or what in fact happened, we hired another vendor, they have to come forth with facts to say, oh, no, you didn't. We did that. We perform the touchstones that allow us under the contract to get paid. And that's where we're off the track here.
They say there's a genuine issue of triable fact on that point. Your view is they did not create such a genuine issue?
No, sir, that's correct. And the reason for that is because Judge Sykes has correctly portended that the analysis that the district court put forth takes care of both of those issues by finding that, first of all, Star had the unequivocal final decision, after all is said and done, to decide whether that recommendation was good, bad, operationally sufficient, or indifferent. And secondly, because there is an absence of an exclusivity provision, we had the opportunity at all terms to go out and look at other vendors. We had the opportunity to compare softwares. We had the opportunity to compare lobby brochures. We had the opportunity to compare ease of installation. We had the opportunity to compare instruction manuals. At the end of the day, after all this analysis was done, it was Star's final decision, unfettered, as to whether or not to accept, adopt, or install Star's program.
Thank you.
So the question that I asked earlier, the number of consultants on this issue was unlimited, and you could hire 10 consultants on this.
Yes, sir. As the facts indicate, we have used consultants many, many times for many, many different reasons. And the crux of this engagement letter is does not prevent us from going out and doing exactly that. And that's exactly what happened in this case. At the end of the day, at the end of all this complicated analysis that we read about in the briefs, our client decided that there are other vendors that have substantially better programs, both in the overdraft protection realm and also the sale to credit card portfolio. Now, the district court took these two issues about cutting out the final decision language and adding in the language would have supplied an exclusivity provision and decided not once but twice that that was a perversion of basic contract law. The opinion below, in plain language and common sense analysis, applies an unambiguous set of contract provisions. In fact, the unambiguousness of this contract is about the only thing the two sides agree on. Floyd, in his briefs, and again today, simply invites his court to rewrite the contract and exclude something that's there and include something that's not there. But the district court rejected this invitation twice, as should this court. Now, let me touch on what I believe is the touchstone of what the district court found. The district court did a very straightforward and workmanlike analysis of this final say provision that appears in the John Floyd engagement letter. At the outset, we need to point out again that we paid John Floyd $110,000. Now, for the bundle of rights that we bought for $110,000, the most important one was to reserve unto ourselves the final decision to decide after all the analysis had been done whether that was the thing that we should do. A simple reading of that final analysis clause does away with lots of arguments that you heard both in the Floyd brief and here this morning. Between the time we paid the $100,000 and between the time we had to make a final decision, we had the absolute discretion to do exactly some of the things we've already talked about this morning: absorb any painstaking financial analysis that they had done, look at the software system, see if one vendor had one vendor did not have one, whether one software program was better and more compatible with our bank's mainframe than another. We were able to compare methods and ease and timing of installation, how it would affect our employees. And we were also able to look at other consultants because, as the district judge pointed out, the ideas that we're talking about here are easily found elsewhere in the marketplace. And, in fact, we even bought ourselves the opportunity to procrastinate if we wanted to. You may have noticed in the briefs that Mr. Tom Marcuselli did, in fact, procrastinate for a while before he finally decided that the bank should use Kessler Financial Services for its credit card portfolio. But after all this is said and done, the district court properly held that the Star Financial Bank retained the unfettered right to make the choice. Now, as a corollary to the final decision, the district court also was correct in saying that all these analytical steps led up to the decision were not in and of themselves enough to generate a consulting fee. They might have generated some ideas, some lights might have gone on. However, that did not put the installation in process so that STAR's customers would be benefited. The most important standalone finding in the district court's opinion is found at page 20, where it said, quote, "The party's contract is not for the sale of ideas, which in this case were readily available elsewhere, but for the service of implementing the details that make the ideas work for the defendant." Now, Floyd's position is all we had to do was put an idea into your head, and thereafter you are precluded from going out and finding another vendor for an infinite amount of time and using that vendor to put in the installation. Well, simply stated, that turns the contract on its head. The crux of this engagement letter was to have this consultant come in, do the work, and then do the actual work to put in the recommendation. Now, what is this work that we're talking about? The work was carefully called out by Floyd's engagement letter. There were four phases that Floyd themselves put into their letter. There's analysis, there's recommendation, there's installation, and there's review. These are all action items. These are all transitive verbs. These are all things that the consultant must do before coming to the pay table. It's inconceivable to us how the other side could say in their brief at page 25 that the district court's analysis on all this work stuff was ultimately irrelevant. Floyd would like to have the district court and this court stop after the first two phases, that is, the analysis and recommendation, and say to you, okay, we recommended a good idea, and you ultimately put in something like that idea, or even an identical idea, so now pay us. But that construction would fly in the face of items 3 and 4 on this list, which are installation and review. Now, the district court aptly said that that's really a nonsensical reading of the contract, because why would you need items number 3 and 4, which are installation and review, if all you had to do was analyze and then recommendation? The game would be over. We also made the point in our brief, and I think Judge Sykes alluded to this just a minute ago, that numbers 3 and 4 in their work list are necessary because that's how they get compensated. Unless they install put in measures to measure the success and see how it goes, there's no measuring stick by which they could get paid. So in summary, on the final decision issue, the district court came to two very commonsensical and very plain meaning conclusions. Number one, if you don't do the work, you don't get compensation. And number two, at the end of the engagement, final decision means final decision. It was not a one-sided contract. My colleague referred to the National Standard case, which was decided by Judge Posner, but the holding in that case was there was nothing one-sided about the closing agreement in that tax case. So that's that does not help the resolution of this. Now, the end around that John Floyd has given this court and tried in the district court was, when you look at what Starr did, Starr really did install our recommendations. Even if John Floyd did not install, they actually pick up the wrench and the pliers and the computer and put it in, as Judge Keeney indicated, they say what Starr really did was install their recommendation. Well, Your Honors, that begs the question under the lexicon of Rule 56, because once, let me just use the credit card portfolio example as an example. Once Starr came forward with evidence that Kessler Financial Services negotiated the agreement, did the confidentiality work, gathered the portfolio information about Starr's existing credit card portfolio, contracted the MBNA bank as a buyer, and then closed the deal, that stands uncontroverted. Once that gets into the record, John Floyd has to come forward under Rule 66 and say, well, maybe you did, maybe you didn't. But John Floyd also did those four things. Those are four things that John Floyd put in the work list in the engagement letter. And the record is absolutely barren of any such action items on John Floyd's part. The only thing that Floyd has raised in that regard as an issue is one of similarity of result. And we know from the district court's very careful analysis, the similar result or even the identical result doesn't make it, because these ideas were fairly commonplace in a very competitive banking market. You can walk into virtually any lobby in any bank and find some type of an overdraft protection program for your checking account. So the only thing that Floyd has raised with respect to that issue is an immaterial issue as to whether or not it might be similar, whether or not it's even identical. There is no evidence, however, Judge Drippel, that there is any material fact arising out of whether or not John Floyd carried out its own work order. The record is absolutely barren about that. Let me now turn to the exclusivity issue, and this is the second focal point of the district court's decision. It goes very nicely hand-in-hand with the final decision issue. The district court easily spotted the omission which John Floyd is trying to have this court put into the contract today and trying mightily to cure. That provision would be some type of a provision that says this is an exclusive contract. Once Starr inks the line, it cannot go to another vendor. It cannot look elsewhere. It cannot use anybody but Starr for its consulting services. If that were the case, Starr would... There is simply no requirement, and there's no inference of such an exclusivity requirement in this contract. As a result, Starr is free to solicit second opinions. In the language of the district court, Starr is able to find a better deal before Starr embarks on the third phase of that contract, which is to actually put the meat on the table and get the program done. And it also would permit Starr to contract with other consultants. And again, if I may refer quickly to the district court's opinion at page 21, her key finding is, quote, the plaintiff is not entitled to payment for competitor's installation of a program, even if the program is similar to or the same as the one recommended by the plaintiff. Now, the exclusivity omission dovetails quite nicely with the inclusion and emphasis on the final decision, because when taken together, that emphasizes that this contract is not simply for the sale of ideas. The ideas are readily available in the marketplace. Starr is completely free to reject a recommendation. And most importantly, payment is not due until the consultant actually installs and brings those ideas to the marketplace for the benefit of Starr and its customers. Now, this exclusivity argument is all the more persuasive because Floyd absolutely ignores the legal importance of this clause. In the district court's opinion, she set forth the Inman case, which is the Indiana legal underpinning for the fact that courts will not read into a contract an exclusivity provision where it's not inferred, it's not bargained for, and it's simply not there. We recognize that in our brief. We also recognize that this circuit is no stranger to exclusivity provisions. And we invited the court's attention to the Baxter Healthcare case, the Brooklyn Bagel Boys case, and the Muth case, all of which together stand for the proposition that if between two sophisticated parties dealing at arm's length, if there's no exclusivity provision in the contract, the court will not add one. It will not supply one. There's no legal basis for the adding of such a kind of a provision.
Well, in this regard, counsel, this particular Floyd contract is a little bit different than some of the other John Floyd consulting contracts that have been litigated in other circuits, in particular the Third Circuit case that was submitted on a Rule 28 supplemental authority submission. And in that contract, there wasn't an exclusivity provision per se, but there was a provision that said, first of all, if a recommendation is not approved, it won't be included in the fee calculation. But if at any point during the 2 years following the initial engagement, 24 months following the initial engagement, a recommendation is approved or modified, and then approved as modified, then it will be included. So Floyd protected itself in other of its consulting contracts in a way that it did not in this case.
Very interesting observation, Your Honor, and the chronology of that is such that the clause that you read about in that supplemental authority that they supplied to the court happened several months after we had fallen out of bed with Floyd. So basically they learned from their mistake, which they made in the Star engagement letter, and they fixed it. I think you'll also note in that contract there's a 24-month period, which is not in our engagement letter, and the contract language in that is totally different in this one. Frankly, they went to school on that one. The later Star or the later Floyd contracts are better. They plugged this loophole. Your Honor, the final point on exclusivity is, since they conspicuously ignore the very guts of the district court's holding, that silence reverberates. Now, just a few comments on the condition preceding. Your Honors, that is, and I've waited weeks to use this word, it's a frolicking detour with a destination that goes nowhere. When you boil it down, what they're saying is, Floyd says, we don't really have to install this ourselves. They're accusing the district court of adding a condition or adding a contract or a provision that says, oh, yes, you do. But Your Honors, that requirement to actually do the work is already built into their own contract by virtue of these four phases. That argument is belied by the fact that the four work phases carefully talk about the integral the four phases have to be done. And the district court picked up on that and at page 21 put this issue to rest by saying plaintiff must show that it installed its recommendations and the defendant did not compensate it. So the John Floyd cannot get away by saying, well, we get paid even if it turns out that you put in something that certainly looks like ours. I see my time is winding down. I'll leave to the courts looking at our briefs for the discussions about how conditions are not favored in the law, and particularly the Scott Wright's case, which indicates that that's an argument that plaintiff tried in that case. It was rejected. They're simply stated there is no traditional conditional or contingency language in our letter. In conclusion, we would submit that Floyd received absolutely every benefit of its bargain. It was paid $110,000 up front, fully knowing, and at the time it took that check, that the bank had the final decision on any recommendation that they might make, and fully understanding that there was no exclusivity provision and that the door was open. And again, under Rule 56 lexicon, there is no genuine issue of fact as to the fact that, or issue, that Star did exactly what it had the right to do, and that was go elsewhere to buy its courtesy coverage and go elsewhere to buy the sale of the credit card portfolio. I would respectfully submit that Judge Springman, not once but twice, in very careful 20-page opinions, laid out all these issues, and we would suggest that her opinion is adaptable by this court as its own. The district court was right twice, and it should be affirmed in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Hiddle. And Mr. Fenton has 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
I just make a couple of points. Once again, there was reference to this $110,000. It was a fully refundable retainer. It was not consideration for anything. It was a down payment on what they would have had to pay us once a contingency fee was generated. So arguments that that somehow compensates us or is consideration for something in this agreement, simply not correct. As to phases 3 and 4 of the contract, the evidence is actually undisputed in our favor that we were ready, willing, and able to perform and were prevented by the bank from performing those phases. To the extent that that's a failure of condition or with, to the extent that that's treated as a breach of promise on our part, they are claimed to be a breach of promise on our part, that simply cannot be a defense.
I don't think that claim is being made, counsel. The claim that's being made is that those are part of the contractual obligations if the bank accepts and approves a recommendation.
If the bank accepts and approves a recommendation, we agreed that we would install, absolutely.
Right.
Our position, though, Your Honor, is that there's a question of fact as to whether the bank approved and installed our recommendation by using another installer, and that the failure to pay us under those circumstances breaches the compensation provisions. I would also point out in the very little time I have, if you look at the credit card portfolio sale, there was no other consultant involved in that case. They followed our recommendations absolutely to a T. We told them to sell the credit card portfolio to a company such as MBNA, a leader in the industry, and 2 months later they decided to sell the credit card portfolio to a company to MBNA.
As I understand the record, though, at the time that you made that recommendation, the bank was already in negotiations with Kessler and told you on the spot that it was rejecting that recommendation and had already been in negotiations.
The bank claims that they were in negotiations. They had had some contact with Kessler, but I believe if you look at the record, not record citations, there's a question of fact. The district court itself came to the conclusion that there was a dispute of fact as to whether or not it was our recommendation which caused them to sell the credit card portfolio. She agreed with us on that point and disagreed with the bank's argument that they were already in negotiations with Kessler. So I think that if you look at even at the district court's opinion, she denied summary judgment or refused to give them summary judgment on that particular basis. That's all I have, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Fenton. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.